hello.
Oh.
I think I'll read some poems. I guess that's why you're here. I just went over these a second ago, about a half hour, and all of a sudden I can't remember anything I did now. By the way, relax. If anybody gets uptight, let me get uptight. And just relax. If you want to ask questions or raise your hand and you have to leave the room or whatever, if you want to ask, say something, feel free to. Because this, if you've never been to a poetry reading before, this is your first one, right? Yeah. And there's nothing sacred, there's no rules. Just settle back and let me read, and we'll talk if you want to talk about them. I'll try to tell you some of the things that led up to the poems sometimes, because I think putting them in a context may help kind of set the stage where they came from. I was just seeing if I could find any Thousand Oaks poems, and I know without even looking I don't have any. Somebody the other day asked me if I had any poems about Los Angeles. I said no, and I told him I'd been a scuba diver for 15 years. And I said, do you have any poems about that? And I said, no. They said, what do you write about? And I said, Nebraska, Illinois, Shangri-La, El Dorado, wherever it is, Holden Village. But not Southern California, even though I've lived there since 1940. Well, let me start off with a poem here. I think I'll start off with some religious poems. I wound up with a couple of religious poems the other night. Let me start off with that. I wrote a series of poems about Mary a few years back. And because I was always fascinated with the idea of Mary, where she came from, how she got there. Eve. And what Adam's reaction might have been when he woke up and there she was. Hadn't counted on that. And this is, you know, just being alive is pretty good. And to find out he's got somebody there, well, that's gravy. I guess that's what he thought. Maybe he was disappointed. After all, now he had to share things. You know, and he and Eve had to set about naming everything in the forest in Eden. We'll call this a bear, and I'm a mouse. Imagine how long that took to name things. Whales, spiders. But I'm sure he wasn't interested in naming things right off the bat when he first opened his eyes and it was Eve. So these five poems, I've only got four poems. The fifth one's in a book. These five poems kind of follow the creation of Eve and what maybe some of Adam's thoughts on the whole idea. Let me find the last one here before I start. Okay. The Bible doesn't say a whole lot about that, you know. I can remember as a boy in Good Shepherd Lutheran School in Inglewood, California, being disappointed more than once about the Bible's terseness about creation and about Eve. I said, I want to hear more about this. Well, I didn't get much. And I'd asked Mr. Uffelman, Walter Uffelman, who was 9 feet tall and weighed 500 pounds. I'd say, Mr. Uffelman, is he quiet, Jack? Write 500 sentences. I will not ask. Hey, I was always writing sentences for this and that. Do not kiss girls in cloakroom. Do not break windows with balls. So I finally taped three pencils together so I could just start right off the bat. And sometimes I'd stay in for, if nothing was happening at recess, I couldn't get a fight going or anything, I'd stay in, I'd just start writing sentences. And after a while, I had a whole bunch of them, I will not, one thing or another. And when he nailed me, I just kind of go through my file and see what I had. I guess that's not so unusual, is it? I hope not. Good old Mr. Elfman. I remember one time going to the catechism, he was saying all the thou shalt nots, and thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's ox. And, you know, nor is the ass, nor is the manservant, nor is the maidservant, anything is thy neighbor's. And I remember raising my hand and said, "Mr. Uffman," he said, "What?" Very patient man. I said, "None of my neighbors have any oxen." And he stopped and he looked down at me from his great height. I just shriveled like he said, "Be quiet." I was quiet. But I couldn't figure out how I could not covet. I always felt that maybe I lived in a deprived neighborhood. Nobody had any oxen. I used to wonder if my neighbor had an oxen. I used to kind of daydream about going to the fence someday, and there was a knothole about eye level when I was in the sixth grade, my neighbor's fence, and I could just kind of daydream about going up that fence and putting my eye to this knothole and having seen this great kind of a milky, watery blue eyeball of a great ox staring right back. And I could kind of look at it and see if I wanted to covet it or not. None of that ever happened. Well, these are Eve poems. First one starts out as morning. Morning. But then there was peace of rarest kind as air. Adam saw the suns, stars, ate and slept. There was no want. And as he grew, a quiet sense came near, some other thing. He listened, rather felt immense change draw near. So he knelt and drank, wondered, listened, tried to catch the felt breath like air that thundered through him as song. And Adam slept and dreamed some silent course along, some hidden ways kept until just this time. A gift, and just there in a waning night, a stir or call, some subtle shift, and Eve slept in amber light. Okay, the second in this series of five is titled Adam Woke. Adam woke and stared dumbly at the star-dark night, felt the pull and sweep of power, put his hand on his side and groaned. The mud moved slowly at his feet, then crossed like vines upon his legs. Eve lifted pooled eyes and waited. Thunder crashed along the carving channels of the void, and warm winds came. Adam dropped beside her, trembling, sought her mouth, and in the lightning's flash the forest moved, then burned the eyes of God. As I read these to myself, I know why I didn't show these to Mr. Uffman, even if I had written them in, which I didn't. All right, the third one, and Eve sang, Eve is there, and she's made her presence felt for some time, whatever period of time now. And she arched her neck to the sun. Adam wondered. Eve tossed her head and framed the sun with hair that spun circles in a mazy light. Adam saw her hair catch fire, and Eve sang bird carols, plaited woodbine in her hair, tasted salt on Adam's palm, smiled as he drew back. And Eve turned away into the woods. Adam watched her shadow, silent on the ground, reach his legs and knew pain. And the fourth one is titled The Loss of Innocence. Eve bathed herself beneath the forest spring. She saw the marble leaves green on the water, their shadows on her legs, floating, floating on her legs. And lying back, she moaned aloud, saw the veins and leaves, heard fish dark beneath the rock, listened to the silence whisper, whisper. Eve swam in heaving oceans, knew the primal flood and tide. She felt the crack of chrysalis, her eyes turn inward. Then rolled the heavy sky between the pallid moon and Eve. Then came the night, sudden then the sounds, a padding, close, scenting on the moss. She screamed, arms across her breasts, but silence now and forever. And the last in that series is entitled, simply, Call Her Eve. And Adam rose and looked at her, eyes down, hands resting on the ground. She moved her shoulders, raised to meet his glance. waited as he gazed beyond the heavy sun, twisting his mind for feelings, words, and he knew there was a difference, a quiet change. Before, their laughter hung in air as bells on summer nights. Now eyes, once easy, light, grew fretful, forced a path to secret skies or dropped distant, clouded to the forest floor, that turned eyes inward in winged shafts of light that scorched the nerves, flailed the troubled dreams. Then she turned, shoulders first, so, as soft bird throats turn. Her eyes shone as mist beneath the falls, and lifted arms caused a hush beneath the trees. The fox dropped low, the quail gathered, and nights blended into days of words unsaid, daring sense to drown and call it song. Well, that's a beginning. Poems of Eve. I wanted to... Did Kathy come in? She's going to take off early, right? Okay. I want to read a poem now called Blazak Kula. That's an unusual name. I taught in Nebraska for a while in the 60s, and I lived there in Seward, the place Jerry Evenry can't find. I taught there every summer, or lived in Seward from 64 up until 73. And that area of southeastern Nebraska is called the Bohemian Alps, and a lot of Bohemian people live there. And nothing better than to go out and eat fish and drink beer on Friday nights, and or go to a Polish wedding, or just stomp around doing things out in the hills. And they have great names, some of those people. Blazak Kula is a great name. And we had gone to Nebraska in 72 in the summer, late summer, and for the year. And we had this old frame house that we were going to live in. It had no furniture, nothing. We brought the kids and bikes and the dogs. Looked like the Joes moving from Oklahoma. And the bike strapped on top, and the dogs barking and foaming at the mouth and trying to snap it at its service station attendants and just generally running amok on Highway 80. But we finally got there intact. But I did take the television set. I figured that was one thing you can't go for. You can do without furniture, but you got to have a television set. So I plugged that thing in. I put my kids on the floor and I watched that for at least 9 months, and don't ask me any questions because Daddy's got a lot of work to do this year. And we were doing something in the room there, and the TV came on, and this very funereal-looking face said, "Blazak Kula died on his tractor." That was all. I looked at Dolores and I said, "Did you hear that? Blazak Kula died on his tractor." And I was listening, but that was it. He was gone. He was doing something else, some other report. And I went over the TV and I almost shook it. I said, "Don't stop there. I want to know why old Blazak died on his tractor. How come? Then what do they do?" And that was all I got. I said, "Well, we're in Nebraska. That's all you get in Nebraska, is one-liners." Walter Cronkite, he wasn't, you know. But it was so serious about it, and I thought, what a name. Blazak Kula died on his tractor. Well, that haunted me for a long time, and until finally the poem came about. And I'd like to, was talking to Elmer Anderson today, and he was telling me that he had known a friend or two that had died rather suddenly like that, not necessarily on tractors, but just had died unexpectedly. So I want to, and we've had some good conversations, so I want to dedicate this poem to Elmer. This is called Blazak Kula. Blazak Kula died on his tractor, not under it, or because of it. He died on his tractor. The evening news sandwiched it in between the Funk's hybrid commercial and the weather report from Hastings, Grand Island, New York. It was very hot the day Blazak Kula died. All the fans were whirring in the Seward County Courthouse, dragging their great black-bladed fans across the sweat-darkened tops of rooms, where men sat with eye shades and sleeve holders, reckoning time by holes punched and dogs licensed. His wife of 57 years gathered eggs from the barn and clucked the big Rhode Island Red off her nest. When he didn't return for lemonade and fish at noon, she went to the cool, dark cellar for jars. She saw the county pickup bounce through the gate and raise the dust against the whitewashed house. She watched the men from the screen window of the root cellar, the cold jars and brown eggs in her basket. You are relaxed out there, aren't you? If you feel like saying anything, or clapping, or just moaning, or doing nothing, do that. Remember, whatever you want. I usually have to mention this before in a reading, because a lot of times you feel like clapping when the choir, Jerry's choir, is reading. I kind of bite my fingers. One of these days I'm going to clap anyway, decorum or no. So if you feel like it, do it. There's a... Oh, come on. Thank you. Is that fishing? Well, then I'm fishing. Okay. There's a cemetery in Milford. Anybody from Nebraska in here?
I know
Milford. The Milford off-ramp and the Seward off-ramp, you get there before 24 miles before you get to Lincoln. All right, well, and there's absolutely nothing to see in either place. But I had spent the summer reading all kinds of stuff, or the fall, I guess, and one of the books I had read, I was reading a lot of Indian literature, books by Indians and about Indians, and a lot of Sioux stuff. And I had met a holy man, a Brule Sioux, in Lincoln, and he carved me a pipe in the shape of a duck. And we had a lot of conversations. And one of the books I read that fall was Bearing My Heart at Wounded Knee, which, if you've read it, you know, is a very depressing book. And I came across one line that said, Prairie Flower, daughter of the chief of the Ponca Indians, had died in Milford, Nebraska, as they were coming back from the territory on the way back to their campgrounds. And the ladies in Milford gave her a Christian burial. And that was all it said about it. I thought that was interesting for two things. I was only 6 miles from Milford. And the fact they gave her a Christian burial, I think must have amused an awful lot of Indians who were wondering what they were doing, sticking her in the ground like that. But at any rate, we went out to try to find Prairie Flower's grave. And we couldn't find it. But it was an unusual day. The weather was about to break with something. You know, the horizon gets dark and you can feel it in the air and you know that something's coming. It was that kind of a day, and we didn't find the grave, but it did lead to this poem called Cemetery at Milford, Nebraska. The road dropped between bluffs, the river dammed by white rocks, while light leaves hid wrecks of cars and refrigerators beyond the curve of water. The tombstones rose as spiky grass and notched the rolling blue-black clouds as we pulled into the gravel drive. The storm was close and the sky grew dark. We wandered over the wet grass, reading names aloud until our voices grated and we drifted singly in all directions like blown petals over the graves. The sudden bang and screech of metal, pounding of hooves, jangling of bit and snaffle, turned me to the rows of wooden markers set against the furthest corner. I read them left to right, humming the names and dates. Infantry from Illinois, Ohio, New York. So many here. My eyes trying to reach beneath the ground, but failing. So I raised my eyes to the prairie flooded in green, with the gray clouds lying on the horizon, sending ripples through the ground, touching me there in the wet grass. And we stood as islands, alone. As the storm came and the wind drove the rain against the old markers, and the grass broke against our legs. Thank you. I shouldn't have said anything about that. Now, don't feel nervous, will you? It's all right to sit there, really. While we were in Seward, we attended church, St. John's Lutheran Church, which is the largest church around, which is kind of a treat to see the Lutheran church, the large church, and everybody else the little one, whereas in Southern California it's the other way around, usually. We attended St. John's Church, and I had kind of a favorite bench that I liked very much because on the right-hand side, because the light would come in and there's a chipped glass of, it's a beautiful church, albeit it looks like Howard Johnson's, but it's still not a bad church inside. But the outside is kind of hokey. But, yeah, well, they did things in typical Seward fashion. friend of mine sculpted the baptismal font and the altar and the pulpit out of white concrete, just plain white concrete, and then did mosaic tile with the corn and wheat shooting up through green ground and very beautiful earth colors. Very striking. But then the good citizens of Seward thought, well, we can't just have that, so they put a fence around the altar, a wrought iron gate fence. It's just a horrible thing. But at any rate, it's a beautiful church. Well, I like to sit there because the sun came in and did things. And the preacher, well, I better not read, tell you about the preacher, I'll just read the poem. It's called Better Than Gospel. The pale sun filtered through the oddly shaped pieces of colored glass and strike the pew in front of me. I was glad for the diversion as the gospel was yet a long way off and the epistle was being sung by the choir who had been coached by Mrs. Kleist in the proper way of choiring epistles. The minister looked dubious and belched into his hymn book. The acolyte stood when he should have sat, and the congregation, ever on the alert for new dimensions in worship, rose. Then the minister had to rise, and the choir director, thinking that some kind of heavenly cue, cut the choir off short. And I, after all, had my spectral sunbeam oozing its way across the lovely pleats of the girl in front in a perfect hush, with everybody standing and waiting for the choir, or the minister, or the acolyte. And I smiled at that, thinking it better than gospel. Yeah, well, we had a good time there. In Seward. I'd like to read to find some poems that are outside of Seward, and I can get as far east as Illinois, I think, and then I run out of gas. Literally. Highway 80, always making it to the next rest stop where we could let our three dogs out of the car, and they immediately bite children and defecate on somebody's sandwich and just horrible things. And then my kids run amok and they bite people. And the car, you know, you open the hood and you say, you think we ought to try the radiators? And no, but it's too late. And somebody, I've tried it and it blows up and boils over. And the mosquitoes, and my wife is crying and I'm cussing. And that's how we went to Nebraska all the time. Just a fun trip every inch. The first time we got as far as St. Cloud, Utah, I think, some town like that. And the dogs were just abominable. It was 100 degrees outside and about 500 inside. And one of them had wet on the back of the wagon. And my little black spaniel, I could see him out of my rearview mirror. He was trying to get up on top of the box. And I said, Tim, why is Blackie up on top of that box? Tim says, don't ask. So we had to, and then just then my wife clutched the headlining as if she, I said, what are you doing in the headlining? She said, there's cars on fire. And I just swerved all over the road and I could see smoke coming all over the car and the dogs were barking and the kids started to cry. So I pulled over and it was something, the oil was getting on the manifold and it was causing smoke and all that. But so it wasn't really serious. But we stopped and I said to the mechanic, I said, can you do something about this so it doesn't happen anymore? He said, well, I can give you a valve job. And I said, no, in 10 minutes can't you do anything? I don't want a valve job. So I thought, we got an apartment. We thought we'd stay in right there. So we got in there and snuck the dogs in the back way. And, you know, the rule of thumb is when you travel with dogs and kids, you eat light, right? So the dogs had eaten light, so I got them in there and gave them a little dish, and they gulped it and immediately threw up all over the carpet. And I said, no, Blackie, no Tanya, no Missy. And talking to Missy was like talking to a polar bear. She's non-compos menace, nobody home. So, and Dolores says, get those dogs out of here. Get them out, just get them out. So I put them on the leash and ran down to this ballpark where kids were, and they immediately went out and stole the baseball and came running back with the baseball and all the team chasing me. So I finally got the dogs corralled and was sitting on them, and some guy drove a pickup truck, and I thought, well, now I've had it, this is it. And the guy came over and he says, I've been watching you and your dogs. He says, do you live here? And I said, no. He said, I thought if you lived here, you'd be willing to instruct us in a dog obedience. You gotta be kidding. I said, I didn't send them out there for that baseball. They just are on your dogs, that's all. So I got the dogs back. We finally went to bed. I don't know why I'm telling you this. Nothing to the point. We got the dogs back and I said, what do we can't have noise all night. We put them in the bathroom. We put them in the bathroom, shut the door. We went to bed. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, I could feel this, Jack, wake up. And I said, what? She says, there's some noise. I said, there's always noise, go to bed. She says, no, I hear a sloshing sound. I said, sloshing? I opened, went to the bathroom, opened the door, flicked on the light, and there's Blackie, he was in the stool all swirling, treading water. And the other dogs are dumbly sitting here watching it. So that was the end of the night right there. No more sleep. Oh, my. Well, I don't know what poem I was going to read, but I'm sure I blew it, whatever it was. Yeah, I know what I was going to read. I'll read a poem that I was going to read. I read last night. And those of you are, when was it, 2 or 3 days ago? It's called I-80. And if you've heard it, you're just going to hear it again. Okay? Because we always went on Interstate 80, and you know where that is. It goes from coast to coast, and it's a good way to get to Nebraska and other places, I suppose. We were never interested in any place but Nebraska. I don't know where it might go. I-80 runs along the Blue River, and the hot station wagons boil over beneath the diseased elms that bear the red X. Next year we're promised pin oaks, croons the elderly lady passing out brochures. The river is green from the trees, green and thick, slow moving between the muddy banks. The plaque reads, prehistoric Indian site. God, all they got in Nebraska's dead Indians, says a man in shorts with black dress shoes and long black socks. Skeeters slap whack with a brochure on rednecks. Hell, let them keep the place. And off on I-80, heading east to education or west to retirement, leaving the blue sluggish in its banks and the Oto bones quiet beneath the green hillock. And there are Oto bones there. And it does say prehistoric Indian site. So next time you're going through Nebraska and you're about 30 miles west of Lincoln, start slowing down. And when you see Milford off ramp, that's the place. And remember where you heard it. Well, you'll probably never get there. Or maybe you've been there. I'd like to do a poem now that's going to require a little more context. I read this last year here. Was anybody in the audience right now that was here last August when I read some poems? Nobody. Well, good. I can lie. I won't. This poem is called Waiting for Christmas, Greenville, Illinois. And the poem came about in a rather unusual way, as well, all poems come about in unusual ways, but some more than others. I was born on a farm in southern Illinois. I was raised on my grandmother's farm, and my cousin and I were like brothers, very close. And we were always being scared to death. For some reason, my grandmother, my uncles, my aunt, there were three houses on the farm, and they all thought that the way to raise kids was to scare them. Scare the hell out of them, constantly. And then you'll be good, or better, if you couldn't be good. And so Bill and I were forever being scared. He said, you kids be good. And I said, why? He said, well, we'll take you down to the gypsies. And they're always pointing over there on the other side of the barn, always over there. Bill and I used to go over there sometimes. We never saw any gypsies, but they're always over there when we weren't being good. And he'd say, did you slop the hogs right? Did you put it in the trough, or did you just open the door and throw it out, you know, towards the hogs? I said, of course we slopped it. We never did slop. We always threw it out. Hogs were, they were all over anyway. Being a good southern Illinois farm, the hogs and chickens just were all over the place. We didn't know what a pen was. They were just around, you know, like dogs. They had 9 dogs and 1,000 cats and hogs and chickens. And a lot of kids around. Well, we were always being scared for some reason. And I can remember very vividly swinging out under the maples and at night in the summertime, catching fireflies with my cousin. And between my grandmother, who was telling us ghost stories, as she always did, and my dad was sitting there, and we were swinging, and she was telling these ghost stories, and Bill and I were grabbing fireflies and trying to stuff them in each other's ear. And all of a sudden, Bill nudges me. He says, look over there. I didn't want to look over there, but of course I did. What's over there? And I saw this white figure in the bushes. And all of a sudden, this white figure jumps out of the bushes, runs up the swing, grabs my cousin Bill, and runs off down the road with him. And my cousin's screaming, and I'm wetting my pants right there. He said, Granny, what is it? We were just little kids, you know. And he ran about, 25, 30 feet, and then stopped and ripped off this white sheet, and it was my uncle, Bill's own father, and held Bill up and says, "Wasn't that fun, Bill?" Set him down, Bill just keeled right over flat. And then my dad laughed, and he and my uncle would nudge each other and run off and say, "Well, we got him that time, George, didn't we? All right. And I was sitting there wet, and Bill was crying, and my grandmother saying, "You see?" And I never knew what that was supposed to be. See what'll happen? And then we'd go to bed, which Bill and I would sleep with my grandmother, and he on one side and me on the other, and we'd tell her, say, "Granny, would you tell us ghost stories?" We always knew we were going to get scared. She said, "Well, you kids been good?" And we'd go through that whole routine again, how we'd been good, because we never were. And then she said, "Well, you get your pajamas on and get in bed, and I'll tell you a ghost story." So we'd start getting our pajamas on, go by the window, all of a sudden a face would come up by the window, like in the window. I'd fall over, wet my pants again. Bill would scream, go running down the stairs. And then I'd kind of get up the courage and peer over the windowsill, and there go my uncle or my dad running across the yard, laughing, slapping each other in the back. Bill would scream, go running down the stairs, and then I'd kind of get up the courage and peer over the windowsill, and there go my uncle or my dad running across the yard, laughing, slapping each other in the back. And I said, "What are they doing? It was scaring us." So Bill and I finally got in the habit of just kind of undressing for bed, flat on our backs on the floor. We didn't want to go by that window. Like this. Because we knew if we went by that window, there'd be somebody just waiting for hours a day, sit out there in the pansies waiting for us to come to the pier. Well, the high point of this whole thing always took place at Christmas for some reason, of all times, and it just kind of built up. And about a week before Christmas, they were always asking us if we were being good. Have we done our chores? Did we curry the horse? Is that what you do, a horse? Curry? It's best for a while on the farm. I forgot what you do. Well, we did it. Whatever we do to horses. And did our thing. And I'd say, "Fine, why do we have to be so good?" And she said, "Because Claus is coming." I said, "Claus is coming?" "Claus?" "Yes, you better be good. Because it's cold. It's going to be a cold Christmas." Well, we gathered around the pot-bellied stove, and in this little room off the long kitchen, and we'd all sit back like we're all doing, our feet up on the pot-belly stove floor. It got so hot you couldn't stand it, and you start moving away. The fire went out, you start coming in. We spent our whole Christmas going like this. I figure all kids did this for a night. And my aunt came in about 3 or 4 days before Christmas with a big bunch of keys, and she turned the lock in the big room and opened it up. And the cold air came shooting out of the big room, and all the furniture had drop cloths on it, and sheets. And we were never allowed in that big room except at Christmas and Easter, I think, or when somebody died or fainted. I remember one time when an aunt of mine fainted, and they wouldn't let me in to see what it looked like. Mm-hmm. And but at occasions like that. And Bill and I looked in there, and all this big, huge room, and she says, "Claus is coming." And Bill and I were just terrified. And I said, "Claus, what is this Claus coming?" So the big night arrived, Christmas Eve, and they took all the drop cloths off. And Bill and I came in, kind of getting all cleaned up. And it was quite a party going on there. My uncles were all gathered around this big table playing pinochle, smoking big cigars, which was the only thing once a year. And my dad invariably got sick, but would never admit it. They were playing euchre. Does that ring a bell, anybody? An old card game? Right. And they're pounding the table and accusing each other of cheating and grabbing their throats and just raising Cain. And on the other side of the room, my aunts and cousins and girls and sisters and things, they're all playing some game where they sat in chairs and somebody stood behind him and he winked at the person, they got to change chairs. And the whole thing was just running amok with good things. And Bill and I sit right in the middle under kind of a big chair. We're huddled together. We didn't know, were we supposed to be happy? Everybody's having a good time. So we kind of loosened up a little bit, and all of a sudden there was a kind of sleigh bell sound, and my uncle stopped the cards, and he said, "Did you hear that?" And he looked at us. I said, "Well, I didn't make this." He says, "Well, probably just the wind." I said, "Well, I hope so." He went back playing. Pretty soon I heard this jingle, jingle, jingle. They stopped playing cards. All of a sudden there was a boom, boom, boom on the door. And my uncle, everybody looked at us again. And what is it? He said, "That's Claus." And my uncle went over to the door, and I can see him now grabbing that white porcelain knob. When I was a kid, I used to go around licking those white knobs for some of that. And I must say, "Don't lick those knobs." He grabbed that knob, he turned and gave us one more look, and then opened the door, and Claus came in. And I mean Claus. He was 9 feet tall, like Mr. Elf, 500 pounds. He had this Santa Claus suit on. And the wind was blowing. It was about 10 degrees below zero. And there was a blizzard outside, naturally. And the wind came in and piled up little bits of snow. And this big, long, white beard flowing like Peter O'Toole out the door like that. In his right hand, he had a corn knife. And the left hand, he had a great big staff. And he marched in there and he had big rat and beady eyes. He said, "Where are the little bastards?" And Bill and I grabbed each other like that and looked. We figured he must mean us. We were the only little bastards in the room, as far as I could say. He said, "Where are those cutthroats?" And everybody looked at us. So old Claus came in, and Bill and I started to wet my pants. "Don't do it. Don't disgrace my parents." So we had this great big bag of toys, a sack of gifts. And my uncle brought it in, and he'd start reading out these names, you know. And, Leslie Ledbetter, and my dad would go up there, and the Santa Claus would always know some embarrassing piece of information about him, which I can never forget. Is, "Didn't I see you down at Hoyman's Tavern the other night?" And my dad would blush and kick the rug and hang his head, and then my aunts would laugh. And one after another, all the people got called up there, and old Claus knew something about all these people. I can't figure out how he knew that. Finally, they got through, and he runs around, and he picks up a gift, and he says, "Billy Ledbetter." My cousin tried to shove me out. I said, "I'm Jack, you're Billy, get up here." So Billy had to go up there, and Claus embarrassed him and asked him all kinds of questions and sent him back and shoved him, and Bill came diving in, and then it was my turn. He said, "Jackie Ledbetter." I got out there and I thought, "Don't wet your pants." Be a big man. And I walked there, I had little short pants on. He says, "Are you Jackie Ledbetter?" I said, "Yes." He says, "Can you sing a song?" I said, "No." "Can you say a piece?" Thundered. I said, "No." He said, "Can you do anything?" I said, "No." He said, "What good are you?" I said, "No good at all. No good at all." He gave me that present. He said, "Turn around." He kicked me right in the fanny and sent me somersaulting back in the chair. And there we sat. And I didn't even open the present. I was too afraid to even touch that thing. He looked around. He said, "Well, you cutthroats, I'm going now." And he says, "I don't know if I'm going to come next year." He says, "A band of thieves if I ever saw." He went on and on calling his names. He went to the door and he grabbed that white porcelain knob. He opened it and turned around and looked at Bill and I again. He took that corn knife and danced like that and went out and shut the door. And all of a sudden they went back playing cards and my aunt said, and Bill and I looked at each other and said, "Is this it? Thank God Christmas is over. You know, another year is gone." And that was it. That was our Christmas. I grew up figuring all children were raised that way. And later on I realized that some boys and girls sang songs about the baby Jesus and had a nice time. They had a decent thing. And we were just scared to death. That was Claus, you see. That left a lot of memories, you know, on the old psyche, a lot of scars. Then I remember several years later, this went on every Christmas, and then 2 or 3 years later, Bill and I were playing in one part of the house where we weren't supposed to be, naturally. And Bill said, "Hey, come here." He called me into my aunt's room, and there on the bed was a Santa Claus suit, and the mask, and the white beard, and the whole thing. And I looked at that thing, and I thought, what a ripoff. I've been scared, you know what, for all these years, and it's good old Uncle Lewis, all the time. No wonder he had all this information on my dad and my uncles and my aunts. And that was kind of the cracking of the chrysalis right there, you know. But I never forgot those experiences. And for years later, I'd have nightmares. Well, for, you know, 20 years later, I'd dream at night that I was on the farm, and I'd be going out to the barnyard, opening some door, an outhouse or a barn or some tool shed, and there would stand Claus, gazing at me with those red eyes with that corn knife. There's a dream to have, I'll tell you. Well, it led to a poem. 30 years later, the poem came about. I just mentioned that just as by kind of way of introduction, because Rich and I and Jerry and then Dale had a forum the other night about the nature of creativity or the nature of the artist and how things get done. And they don't always get done when you want them to get done. Sometimes poems, at any rate, sometimes take a while. And this one, for some reason, took 30 years to kind of seep up the various layers of the psyche, and it came out. If I can find it here, I'll read it. It's called Waiting for Christmas, Greenville, Illinois. Greenville's where I was born. And that's where it all happened. There it is. Greenville, Waiting for Christmas, Greenville, Illinois. They played the Victrola until dark and then carefully closed the great wooden lid and put away the thick, heavy records. Then the pot-bellied stove was lit and Stokes would sit in the corner chewing and spitting in the wood box in the same corner. Grandma would scold him, push his feet off the stove and tell him to go away. And while the laughter rose and fell like shadows, we listened for something outside the room, some sound of silence that we heard within the very walls themselves. And each night would find us sitting, talking, being the same people in the same corners, listening to the same magical sounds inside our hearts and within the walls, to the cold wind blowing outside, to the meaningless scrabble of sounds on the walls of our brains. And each would be afraid to look in the other's eyes for fear it was real, alive, here, and waiting. And we waited for Christmas. Waited for that dreadful knock that meant the world had cracked, and we would be engulfed into the blackness surrounding the man who would stand in the doorway, a long white beard flowing about his shoulders, staff pounding the old floor, calling us by name. Of course, not all memories are bad, are they, from far? And I remember I went back to visit years later to Greenville, and my cousin was doing the Santa Claus thing, and my kids were very small, and he says, "You want to do Claus?" I said, "No way. Leave him alone." And he was disappointed at that. He had inherited the suit, you know, he's going to come in with a corner. I said, "No, Jim, no, I'm wetting my pants." And I don't want my kids scared to death. Well, I think I might, I don't want to read you to death, as Mark Twain says, that's a bad way to go, to be read to death. And I've already been reading for a while. So do you have any questions or comments? Then maybe I can close with a poem or two, because if I shift into second, I can read for another hour, and I don't want to do that. My voice is cracking, and your tailbone is probably cracking. One thing you do too much in a holding is eat and sit. Are there any questions or comments of any kind? They don't have to be, but I should leave room for them.
I could stand here like cottage cheese.
Could you really?
You said that.
All right. Yeah. Did I?
Yeah.
All right. I get a little bit paranoid about repeating myself, but I never turned down a request. How many of you heard this the other night? So, well, you all heard it. Can you all stand here again?
Sure.
All right. How many of you didn't hear it? Oh, well. All right. I can never find it because I always start looking under C's for cottage cheese, and that's not the name of it. It's Bright Spot Cafe. That's what it is. I can never find the poem. Well, for those of you who weren't here tonight, this happened when I was lost in northern Iowa, going north from Forest City. Do I have that right now? Where Waldorf College is.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, bound for St. Olaf. And I got lost in Forest City, and I got lost in Northfield, and I was supposed to report to Northfield, and I missed the class there and stood around thumping my tooth for 2 hours. And in Waldorf, I stood there, and nobody even said hello. I stood in the hall, and it was, so the whole thing was a waste of time. So I was heading back to the cities, and I was going to leave Minneapolis. Anyway, I saw I was tired and hungry, and I pulled off the road to get a cup of coffee and something to eat, and it's called Bright Spot Cafe. The sign read, "Eat," and in soft April rain, I pulled across the graveled White Rock Road. "Use other door," but there wasn't but one door, while inside the old-timers laughed and pointed at my fumbling. Inside, into a quiet table, and the waitress. "Bring me a cheeseburger and coffee." "Want the cottage cheese?" No, just a cheeseburger and coffee. Don't you want the cottage cheese? No, just, how about them french fries? She stood a while as I studied the tablecloth, then sidled over to the window and gave my order. And you don't want the cottage cheese? Such a hush then. The ramrod-backed farmers turned on their stools to gape my way. I flushed hot and studied the mysteries of my menu that showed the map of Iowa saying, you are here, Dubuque is. And finally looked up at eating faces, all engrossed in their cottage cheese. The man across the aisle shoveling it in while his mother gave him four with each mouthful. I say no mutton chops. Mustache, okay, but them chops point to your nose, Rogers. And the words trailing off to a table next to mine, Dewey's is the best. There's a new man there who lays them out so natural you wouldn't believe it, and is reasonable. $74 gets your casket, read the forget-me-nots, and add the advocate. And that new man lays them out so natural. And finally, my cheeseburger. Small, rounded, cheese unmelted. I look in vain for onion, pickle, lettuce. And the hovering waitress, noticing my hesitation. Now you want your cottage cheese? And silence again in the bright spot cafe. As chrome stools turn, farmers look, and conversations hang suspended in beatific silence. Yes, I say, and Iowa resumes its humanistic center of the universe as heresies and dreams alike are laid to rest, looking very natural. Now, do you have any questions or comments?
The next way to go.
Oh, you've been a good audience. This is a good place to read poetry. I hope it's a good place to hear poetry. It's a good place to do anything, come to think of it, right? As Frost said, one could do worse than be a swinger of birches, and one could do worse than be in Pennsylvania. A lot worse, don't you? Well, I don't know how I'm going to top that, but I'd like to leave you with a poem, just by way of saying goodnight. This poem caused a little controversy when I published it in the Lutheran Witness, because it was published, I did a series of religious poems for 2 years in the Lutheran Witness, which is a magazine from Lutheran Church, Dash, Missouri Synod. And well, they still have a Dash, and pretty soon that's all they're going to have, I'm afraid. But we were doing a series of art and poems on classical paintings. And we did one on marriage. Bill Wolfram, an art teacher at Concordia Seward, and I, and he did the picture, iconography on the painting, and I did the poem. And the picture he chose was Arnold Feeney's wedding, which is a very interesting picture. And so I read his iconography, the symbols in Arnold Feeney's wedding. I looked at the painting, and I thought, well, what can I write about marriage? So I wrote a poem for my wife called Sonnet for Dolores. And I got letters from two people in Texas that were sent to the Lutheran Witness who thought that was terrible that somebody should publish a sonnet for his wife in the Lutheran Witness, which is the official organ of the church. And the editor, Omar Stunkel, who was a very fine, creative guy, sent those letters along to me, and to kind of needle me a little bit. But I kind of got the impression that one wasn't supposed to write a sonnet for one's wife in a religious magazine. I don't know what that means, if you carry that out to its ultimate meaning. But I thought that was proper. I still think it's proper, and I'd do it again. Except they won't print my poetry. Anyway, let me leave you. This is a sonnet and for Dolores. You whose eyes are clear as leaves, as bright, as mixed in color as the fall, a sense of movement on the limb that's silent, white against the trees at night, a moon immense and still reflecting quiet on the pond. You whose eyes have told the path I take, the themes I make, the loneliness beyond, a mirroring of the dreams I dream awake. You whose eyes, eternal and alone, go softly through the moments of your day as water chucks against the smoothing stone beneath the bridge, a deepness run away, must know the song, the sense, the untold ways, which mirror in your eyes my quiet praise. Thank you.